For the Christmas spirit, of course. All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
1, 2, 3.
It's a little thing tech show, and that's a fact. If you don't like the cast, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies, that'll link it bad. For the stream length, go direct to DLNGS.org. And ICChannelinsalytics.net. Bound tech show. Just sit right there, cause the cast is just about to begin.
We are streaming episode 332.
Yeah, 323.
There's a whole bunch. Something like that. Great guest tonight. Pat, introduce our guest. Fantastic
guest
stuff.
Everybody, I've been chasing John around for quite a bit. We've got John Cohn, who is an IBM fellow, and probably people know him from the TV show The Colony from the Discovery Channel. John, welcome to the show. It's a great honor talking to you.
Well, thank you, guys.
Now, John, everybody knows you. I guess on the TV show The Colony, they kind of portrayed you as like the professor, the guy always in the lab working on something, coming up with something new, building different things. And you put together some real interesting things in that show. Could you give us a little synopsis of what the show was about and some of the things that you did on there?
Well, yeah, it's pretty easy actually to explain. It's everybody you know is dead, and from there you're on your own. And I think that was pretty much it. There were 10 of us, and we were all put in this. We were brought together. We didn't know each other before. We were brought together into this old huge warehouse, 15,000 square foot warehouse. And the basic idea was we were to live for 58 days on whatever was in that warehouse, with very few exceptions. You know, we were able to go out in very controlled ways to kind of forage in some specific spots, but for the most part, live with what we had. And, you know, our job was to try to, you know, keep ourselves alive, obviously, and restore some sense of, some ability to get through each day with food, water, etc. And there was this surprise element, at least surprise to me, of these bad guys. We called them marauders, but these were there was supposed to be some sort of, you know, global cataclysm. It turned out to be a viral thing, but when we were in there, we were just speculating what it might have been. And we were some of the very few survivors. Some of the other survivors were not the best of people, and they were always attacking us, trying to get our stuff, steal people, etc. So between, you know, struggling for water, food, power, etc., we also had to kind of struggle for our security. And these guys would come in and, you know, all hours of the day, 3 o'clock in the morning, throw bricks through the window, break stuff, etc. So between, those were a lot of challenges. And what we had to do is sort of struggle with those challenges. And at the same time, you know, because it was a Discovery show, Discovery Channel show, we were trying to also demonstrate, you know, what you could do under those constraints, what you could build. So we ended up building all sorts of things, you know, both to sustain us, protect ourselves, and even have some fun. So it was an awesome, just totally awesome experience.
I thought one of the cool things that you guys did was you built a wood gasifier, which is basically a way to convert the burned wood into fuel that an internal combustion engine could use.
Yeah, it was. So we actually went through, you know, a bunch of different kinds of builds, and some of my favorite ones were like the ones you mentioned around power. It turned out that generating electricity was both, you know, a practical necessity because we were in this huge old dark building, but also because we knew that, you know, part of the idea of the show was, you know, was sort of half reality show, half build show. We wanted to be able to make some stuff and to operate. There were, you know, we were reasonably well set out with tools that we had scrounged, including welders and stuff like that. We needed to be able to power them. So when we first got there, it was kind of weird what was in the place to be found. We had a bunch of old car batteries, and we had a fairly large inverter, so we quickly hooked up a little battery bank to run this inverter, but we only had about 3 days of power. And then one of the colonists, Michael, was a very handy mechanical guy. He rigged up a little gasoline engine that we had pulled off of an old pressure washer, I think, and hooked that up to a car alternator, and through that we had a little generator. Well, that worked great, except that we didn't have any gasoline. We only had a couple of gallons of gas. So we could charge the batteries up and keep the inverter running, but we were quickly running out of gas. So we tried to figure out what could we do, that was going to be more sustainable. And the weird thing is, we got very little direction. There was a big production company, people running around with cameras and stuff, but they would never say, go do this, or here's how you do this. They would kind of sit back, and I mean, it was funny. Early on, we kind of go, whoa, we're out of gas. And they'd kind of look at us and go, yeah, you're out of gas. We go, what can we do? And it, in that case, so it was kind of weird, is, cue the flashback music. It was about 30 years ago. I was an exchange student in Austria, and I lived with a family, and I remember my landlady's parents telling me that during the Second World War they had retrofit their cars to run on wood, and the grandmother of the family explained to me that they built a little wood fire, and then they'd have a canister with wood shavings in it, and they would take the gas out and they would put it into their gasoline engines, and it didn't take much work. They just had to keep cutting gas wood, and things would run. And so flash back forward, to the colony, I was going, well, maybe we could try that. And I really had never tried it. I had never really seen it tried, and I was trying to remember a conversation in another language 30 years ago, and that was basically really the way it worked. And the funny thing is, this was pretty early in the show. I think it was like third episode, and I was still pretty naive. Honestly, we never knew what was going to be in, on TV until we saw the show, which was months later. But even at that time, I kind of got the sense, if something didn't work, they wouldn't show it. So we were sort of naively thinking, we'll try it, and if it doesn't work, eh. I later found out that if you tried something and it didn't work, they showed that too, which would have been kind of weird. But so I had no idea that this was really going to work. And what I really liked about it is if you actually watch the episode, it actually relates exactly what we were thinking. I said, hey, I remember doing this. I remember hearing about this. I've never tried it. This is how it works. I kind of mapped out this thing where, there was a firebox below and then a big container above, which would have the wood shavings in, and then we would duct the stuff eventually into the motor. And that first design didn't work, and they showed it not working, which was, I remember at the time being really embarrassed. Oh, I'm going to look like such a doofus, I can't get this thing working, blah, blah, blah. But then I was working with a team of people. Everything we did was with a team, and two of the other colonists, Vlad and Morgan, and I were working on it, and Vlad made the suggestion of lowering the fire, the wood container, the thing that was sort of wood with kind of oxygen-deprived burning, lowering it into the firebox, and we did that, and we were actually able to show that you could take the distillate, which is a mix of stuff, hydrogen, carbon monoxide, some methanol, and light it. And then from there, all we did is we made a big long tube to sort of, one, just practically because we had to have the fire outside, and two, to kind of cool the stuff out because there was a lot of crap in there, tar and stuff. And we rigged it into Michael's generator, this thing with a gas motor, and we had to futz around with it a little bit. We had to make a little carburetor, just kind of like a whistle valve, like a little slit in the pipe that we could cover or uncover to change the air mix. But aside from that, we didn't modify the motor. We'd started it with a couple of drops of gas, because we had to be pretty sparing there. You'd start the thing up, you'd put the gas from the gasifier on there, and then you'd choke off the gas, and the thing would run about 3 hours on a charge of wood. And I was just like, everybody was clapping like, oh, that's really great. And I was going, oh, my God, it works. It was a total surprise. And that was really cool. So that's how we generated our power for about 3 weeks until we built the solar thing. And that was pretty cool, actually. It was one of the first surprising builds where I said, I didn't know we knew how to do that.
Was there any, like, when you talk about the stuff you were building and needing to cool it off, there's always an element of danger or risk involved. Was there any, like, serious accidents or anything that happened shown on the show?
We had a slogan there that was safety third. which we picked up from Burning Man. We were always kind of on. There was a safety team around, and there was a doctor health kind of group, but they would let us push it pretty hard. And not only that, I always got the feeling that they weren't sure what we were doing, since we weren't sure what we were doing, and so nobody was really sure how close to the edge of blowing something up or shocking ourselves or whatever. But we did have several injuries. We actually had 3 hospitalizations, none of which were actually shown. I guess it's okay to talk about this at this point. But we had all manners of minor stuff. You know, I still have scars on my arms and hands from burns and cuts, because we were always doing that. And we always wore our safety glasses, though, so that was good. But I guess, let me think of the most spectacular. We had some, you know, simple sprains and falling down. There's one scene in the last episode where one of the marauders, one of the bad guys, is trying to get into the building. And, you know, we knew that they couldn't kill us, but we didn't know how far they would go. And we were always being surprised at how much we would get beaten up by stuff. And this guy was coming in no matter what, and he had bolt cutters, and he eventually got through the door and knocked over my wife and myself. But anyway, in the process of coming in, I was trying to run this little shock rod outside and see if I could put him on. They grabbed it and pulled it out, so I grabbed a fire extinguisher and started firing it into his face. You know, I'm like, oh, my God, you know, these poor guys aren't, whatever they are, they're not getting paid enough. But he grabbed that thing and pulled it out. This is a big industrial fire extinguisher, and I pulled it back, and in doing that, I pulled his arm across, this jagged cut in the door, and he ended up with stitches. But I think the most spectacular injury was Michael, who is the very good fabricator. He had led a build of making a solar-powered or solar-rechargeable electric car. So he did the mechanicals for this. This was a pretty big, we'd found a 10-horsepower DC motor, and I had helped. So he'd built a frame for this thing using that DC motor and a solid axle, and put together kind of a three-wheeled vehicle, and I built the, I did the electrical system and the speed controller, a little step controller. And this step controller, you know, it's just like an old golf cart, you know, first position, that was a great build because it was made out of all sorts of, busted up old circuit breakers and drawer pulls and old wooden spools. But as you would pull this thing, as you'd turn it, it would go, 12 volts was first gear, 24 volts was second gear, 36 volts, et cetera. And initially, we had 6 gears or 6 speeds. But at about third gear, the thing would go close to 50 miles an hour, and you just didn't want to be on something with a solid axle and not much suspension faster than that. So we kind of limited it to those 3 speeds. Well, one night, and it was kind of the equivalent of our weekend, it was a, we would work 5 days, and then we'd have the 6th day. We didn't really get it off. I mean, we were still in the world. We still had to eat our food, drink our water, sleep in the place. But there wasn't much camera activity on those 6 days because everybody else had to rest. It was on the evening before one of those days, so it would be the equivalent of a Friday night. And Michael started driving that car, the trike, around inside. It was about 11:30 at night. And I remember sitting over, we were working on the truck, and I looked at him, and he'd accidentally gone faster. He'd gone forward when he meant to go back to slow down, and he was going wicked fast inside this building. He hit a pallet, and the whole thing flipped over. And I remember watching. You know how your mind kind of does that slow motion thing, and it was going do 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 do, and it was going no. And anyway, it rolled over on top of him, threw him into my desk. We pulled him out from underneath there, and I really thought he was going to be dead. I mean, because this thing probably weighed maybe 1,600 to 1,800 pounds. He was bleeding like a stuck pig, and there was
battery. He split his head open pretty bad, right?
What? Yeah, he split his head open. He crushed his foot, but he managed to walk away from it, and he ended up in the hospital for the night. And the car was a wreck, and my desk was destroyed. The next day, I found kind of a quarter-inch square of his scalp in my desk. But I was really worried about him. He's an interesting guy. He's a really good builder, kind of complicated guy, but I really enjoyed working with him. He was a piece of work.
See, now, all that runs into what I was going to ask you, which is about, you know, sort of the safety thing. Again, I remember watching this show and seeing... I think it was some episode where you guys were talking with another person about a knife they were carrying or something like that. And I remember seeing that and seeing these marauder people and thinking, like, you know, how much of this really is staged, and is somebody really going to get hurt on the show? You know what I mean? Like,
well,
how far will they take those?
It was
people
weird.
Running around?
You know, we didn't really know. I mean, I personally. And in retrospect, naively, had no idea that would be an element in the show. I think they must have told everybody what they wanted to hear. You know, my big thing is making science fun for people. So I thought it was going to be completely about building things. And I think some of the other people thought it was, you know, going to be about, you know, interpersonal stuff. And I think some people thought it was going to be about bashing people's heads. It was just weird how we all got there. But we never really knew how far. I mean, we knew that they weren't going to let us get hurt badly, but it was surprising how much they would rough us up. And, you know, when we got into fights with some of these guys, they obviously knew what they were doing. So, you know, they would never, like, take a swing at your face or anything, but they would throw you across the room. There was, at one point, this big guy, Andre. We got in fights with him, and two of our guys got roughed up pretty badly, but this guy was, you know, 250 pounds and jacked, and just, you know, I remember at one point he threw Joey across the room, and he smashed George into a wall, and it was kind of like, that's got to hurt. So we were never sure how far they would go, but they made it clear that we couldn't hurt anyone. There was in episode 3, I guess, we did, or 3 or 4, our focus was weapons, because we had been, you know, we had had a couple of break-ins and stuff stolen, and so we had to figure out what we were going to do for that. And, you know, the idea, both from a theme standpoint and from a reality, is we didn't want to really hurt anyone. You know, I guess the actors were getting paid more than we were, you know, than us volunteers, so we didn't want to damage any of them. So they were very clear when we would, you know, like if we had anything with a sharp projectile, we couldn't really fire it at anybody. But anything that was non-lethal, they would let us, like...
So no rail guns, basically.
Well, you know what? It's funny. They didn't show all the weapons that we did, but, you know, I'm a really big-time pacifist. I really believe in peace, and I'm a big peace kind of guy. But, you know, I got really into the weapons build. So my big thing was, I did this sort of neurotic Jewish scientist thing, and I said, well, what could we do? We would make weapons that were so dangerous looking that they would scare you away and make you reconsider, you know, just like the atom bomb arguments that people used to make. So I made scary stuff that could hurt you, but, you know, was more like a flamethrower, that as long as it shot over your head, it would make you reconsider, and if it shot in your face, you were in trouble. So I made stuff like that, but they didn't show as much of the weaponry. I'm not quite sure why, But in the DVD that you can get from Discovery, they showed, for example, we made a for Joey wanted a fast loading, kind of an automatic loading weapon that you could shoot with high precision. So I made him a I worked with Vlad, and we made him a like a fast repeater air rifle. We had a compressor, a small compressor, and this inverter, and you could put that through the side of a car with a metal bolt. And we made Morgan made some clay balls that we could fire through it, which we never hit anybody with it, but you wouldn't want to do that twice. So, and they wouldn't let us fire that at people, but they would let us use the shock rods and stuff that I built. And I think at one point Michael made a really good crossbow, and they wouldn't let that. You know, they made it very clear that we couldn't aim that at anybody living, especially anybody who was paid more than we were. And so they were clear if we were going to get out of hand. If they saw something that could be a weapon that could, or an experiment that was going to really hurt someone, they would step in. But aside from that, it was surprising what they would let us do. And will that be done to us? Especially since I'm sort of a desk job kind of engineer. I wasn't ready for any of that.
What amazed me about the show was everybody in that room was like, they all were very smart people, and they were all very talented. It was almost like it was an engineering conference. You guys were all there, and across the hallway was a medical conference, and that's when the cataclysm hit, and you guys just kind of got together and went off to the warehouse.
You think? I don't know. I've heard that, and it was really fun. One thing that was really fun, you guys, is that we got done filming at the end of April, and then the show didn't air until July. So we were all ready when it came on, and we spent a lot of time watching the blog and Twitter feeds and stuff about the show, which was really fun. And by and large, it was really well received. It was very well received, and I think you'll see this turn into a syndicate like Survivor or something. They're going to be, I guess I can't say anything officially, but my guess is it will continue. Criticisms that we've gotten. I guess two things that I saw as a theme. One was what you said, which is, gosh, that's kind of an unlikely group of people. And the other is, boy, they're awfully well provisioned, And you know what? When we would ask people, on the set, is that realistic? They would have pretty good answers for it. Like you said, if you're in a downtown, it is not completely without possibility that you would have a spread like that. I mean, there were only three people who were really engineers. One guy's a mechanic. One guy's an artist/fabricator, a builder, a marine biologist, a martial artist. They were skilled, but not it wasn't really all like engineers. I mean, it was a little maybe biased towards that. I remember at one time we were sitting around and we realized of the 10 of us, 7 of us could weld. I thought that was kind of cool. But by the time the end of it, I think 100% of us could weld. But I think if they would do it again, they would try to make a more, quote, representative spread. I mean, what would you put on there if you didn't? I mean, what kind of people would you want to see?
I'd have a cop. I'd have a maybe a janitor at a school. I'd have an accountant. I'd have a computer hacker type guy. I'd have maybe a mechanic.
You're doing it all wrong, Pat. That's not what people want to see. They want to see the pharmacist, the fry cook at McDonald's,
the housewife,
a bookseller, and a repo man.
The grandmother who left her insulin away,
yeah.
And a kid, a screaming kid. Well,
so
you know what?
By the third episode, they're cooking up meth. That's what happens.
It might happen. Well, just watch this space. I think it'll be an interesting mix. I think, here's the interesting balance that it was trying to strike is, you know, the guy that created it, Tom Beers, is really a genius, and I work with a lot of smart people in my work, but he is truly a genius, and came up with this idea, and I think it's a very interesting mix between, you know, the normal reality show genre, which I don't know much about. Not before this, I didn't. I'd never seen Survivor or anything like that. And the kind of stock and trade of Discovery Channel, which is more of a build show kind of thing. So they've done a lot of pioneering work like Deadliest Catch and things like that, which are pretty real reality shows. I mean, yeah, it's dramatized a little bit because the cameras are there, but it's real. You know, they're going about their real business. So they wanted it to be of interest to the Discovery Channel viewers, which are kind of scientific and, you know, curiosity driven. But they also wanted something that would appeal to a broader set, so it wasn't just a geek fest. And so they kind of struck an interesting balance. And you know, when I was in the middle, it was funny. It was so amazing, and it almost was along gender lines. You know, that a lot of the people, particularly the women, really wanted it to be about the social experiment and the, you know, what is the interplay between people. And a lot of the other people, mostly guys, were like, nah, you know, let's just build stuff. And I actually, at the time, I would kind of like roll my eyes whenever we would have one of these interactions with the bad, you know, with the marauders and stuff. But watching the show, I think it would have been pretty dull if it didn't have that element, you know, if it was just us sitting around trying to build stuff in a very constrained way. And it would probably be equally, you know, kind of uninteresting to a lot of people if you didn't innovate. So I kind of think it was a, you know, watching it, I thought, wow, it's kind of it's a unique mix, and it got a lot of really good, what do they call it, critically acclaimed. There was some haters out there, but for the most part, the buzz on it was really good. And but I think you're
right.
It had
its deficiencies, but it was really entertaining. I really enjoyed watching it, and I watched it every week while I was on.
Oh, did you really?
I liked it a lot.
Not because you knew you were going to interview us. That's cool.
No. I heard about the show. There was, you know, people were talking about it before the first episode was actually on. And I watched the first episode, and I just kept watching it, and I really enjoyed it.
What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? That's good to hear.
Well, some of the shortcomings was, if it really was the end of the world, I think it would be a lot more violent than anything that was portrayed. You know, people
right.
would be running around with guns, and they'd be killing each other, and I think that would be the reality.
Right. That came up a lot.
Would be.
Yeah.
You know,
you really think people
the
would be that violent to one another?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In an end case scenario,
absolutely.
You think so?
I didn't
before, but I do now. I really do, because, you know, we were in an artificial world, right? You know, we could have walked outside, and we would have been in a downtown L.A., albeit a bad part of downtown L.A. So, you know, we knew we weren't, you know, really in that kind of situation, and yet we were really desperate. We were dehydrated, underfed, sleep deprived, psychologically challenged by being in the small space with each other. And I know that, you know, I could just see what tempers were actually doing and what, you know, perceptions were doing in our somewhat controlled and contrived group. So I would have gone into it. You know, I actually psychologically had to adjust to that, because I'm hippie groovy Vermonter, kind of thinking, well, everybody's really good and everything. And I really came out of that going, yeah, it could be pretty intense. And I think to your point about the guns, there were a lot of comments in the blogs, you know, of the gun, you know, why wouldn't you have guns? There certainly would be plenty around. I think the problem with that is it would have just, you know, presented too much. You know, you can't fake that kind of violence. You know, somebody's dead, they're dead. And you know, when they were trying to strike a balance, it was didn't always work great. But, you know, they wanted it to be as believable to us, so that it was believable to the outside. So that meant there was never a case where they said, "Okay, in 30 minutes, a bunch of masked guys are going to come out in there and they're going to come in that door, act surprised." They would surprise us, and we would never know what was going on. If you introduced real weapons, we would either have to be expendable, and I'd have to be able to replace dead people, or you would have to, script it. Okay, you know, like script battles. So none of the fights and stuff like that were scripted. they just would happen. And I think that just it attests to the fact that they brought in real professionals, that they knew how not to hurt us and how not to get hurt. There were occasional times, you know, actually I remember when Andre and Liz, these were two people who'd shown up and claimed to be sort of previous tenants of the building, and we couldn't tell whether they were people like us, volunteers who were really there, or they were actors, and they actually went out of their way to kind of convince us that they were people like us. And then later on, it turned out that they weren't. But there was a fight where we had to... Is this saying too much? I guess I can say this. You know, that one of our... Allison, one of our people, we had to keep pulling her away from Liz, who was actually an actor, because she kept jumping on her, because we were all so mad at her. And likewise, we had to kind of pull one of our guys off of Andre, who had a weapon. One of our guys had a weapon, and we were like, is this going too... You know, because in the back of our heads, we were really mad and jacked up because these guys had really done some bad stuff to us. On the other hand, you know, in the back of our heads, we're going, wait, cannot hurt the actors. But it was really weird. You could tell that we were right on the edge, because we were a pretty unstable bunch at that point. So I really believe that there would be those bad elements. So anyway, you were going through your critiques. I thought you were right on, actually.
Despite, you know, shortcomings, you know, it's not, you can't simulate the end of the world, you know. But despite that, I thought it was really entertaining. I really enjoyed watching it. I would love to see a TV show with just you building stuff. Honestly, I would think Discovery should do a show.
As they
like
say
that,
in my people, from your mouth to God's ears. I would love to do that. I think. Well, you know what? I'd love to hear. Huh? What would it be? I mean, you know what? Sometimes I used to think, you know, gee, I would like to have, because that's really my dharma. I want to make science fun, cool, and quirky for people. But
I think Discovery ought to bill you out. It's just like John builds cool shit, and I would watch it every week, man.
Would you? Isn't there enough of that on TV right now? I mean, you look at MythBusters, which I love. I think those guys have it really cornered in.
That's a great show.
You know, they have great. And then I kind of look at, there's a whole bunch of clone shows. Maybe we're even one of them, but like Smash Labs, or, you know, and then on one side you have, you know, Mr. Wizard, the old stuff where you have the earnest, you know, stare straight at the camera, do, you know, Simple Science and ooh and ah over it. On the other hand, you have this really over-the-top blow, I guess I should say blow stuff up, BSU, you know, like where you're doing
build it and blow it up. That should be the title of the show.
Well, there's a lot of shows like that, and I don't know that they... What I loved
but
about
there's,
this
there's
show...
There's nothing
is,
like what you did. What you did was a little bit more, excuse me, on the advanced side, and you built neat stuff that worked. And it wasn't all about, you know, just trying to disprove something like MythBusters or trying to blow something up or some kind of kiddie science kind of thing. It was real science stuff that you put
it's
into
practical.
A practical application. You
well,
know,
you know what I loved
like
about
I
it is it was constrained. It was kind of, you know, what we always tried to keep in the back of our head, and they would try to remind us. They'd say, you know, imagine this is a teaching moment. So imagine that bad stuff did happen, you know? What, I mean, and not every build we did sort of kept to this, but what would you do? What if you really did have to, you know, see for your own water or, you know, whatever? And what I think what we demonstrated, you know, it might not be that you would do it exactly the same. I think the one thing I learned is that people are incredibly resourceful. And they, you know, given that something bad had happened and you were really constrained, the stuff around you is actually useful. And I hope that if nothing else, people come away with the thought, not just from what I was doing, but from what everyone was doing, that, you know, you don't have to hang your head. You can actually do stuff. And I was really amazed because, you know, not everybody in there had a really strong technical background, but absolutely everybody to the person could, you know, came up with cool stuff. Now, the show didn't necessarily show all of it either. I mean, maybe 40% of what we did was on camera, real time. If you get, you know, there's some extra stuff out on Discovery's website. There's some different extra stuff on the DVD, but even that gets less than half of it. And absolutely everybody out there was just coming up with cool stuff, and it was really amazing. And I think anybody, you know, secretaries, accountants, whatever, would come up with stuff if the alternatives were, you know, curl up and die. And I think that's a cool message. But I you know, on your point, I would love to find a way to do that more in a public way, because I think that's what. So just can I soapbox for a second?
Do it, man.
Okay, so my real driving force is I love making science fun for people, particularly kids, and I've been doing that for a long time, but when our son passed away about 3 years ago, it just became the thing that's important to me. And I think that there's an interesting kind of moment in the world right now. You know, for the last 2 decades, it's been hard to get kids in the West in particular, so, you know, U.S. and Western Europe, to get really jazzed about science and particularly engineering. You know, it hasn't been so much a problem in like, you know, Pacific Rim and India and stuff, but worldwide it hasn't been going that great. And I think all of a sudden something is kind of getting, and part of, there's a lot of reasons behind it. You know, and we don't really have a good public face for what engineering can do in the world. Well, all of a sudden, the world is changing. You know, I think there's this incredible consensus now on, you know, we got to do something different about energy and climate. No matter what your politics are, whether you believe in global warming or you don't, you can just see economically and politically, we've got to change. It just isn't going to work to rely on energy that you don't control. It's just not, and it'll either happen peacefully or not peacefully. And something, the next 30 years is going to be intense. But I think that kids and teachers and parents around the world are going, you know, technology caused a lot of these problems, that's true, but technology is going to be the solution to a lot of these things, unless you want to go back to the Stone Age. You know, we've got to get more energy efficient, we've got to get, you know, cars better, mass transit, whatever it is, everybody gets that. And I have been going into schools for almost 20 years trying to convince kids to be interested in science by showing them how cool something is inside, a video game, computer, whatever. And that appeals to a small percentage of people, but it didn't really reach everybody, and it certainly didn't reach as well to, like, women, children, or whatever the politically correct, you know, girls. all of a sudden, I go into schools, and people get this sort of engineering to solve world issues, you know, green engineering and stuff. They see that it's necessary. They see that you could make a good living, and I think there's this incredible moment where worldwide, And this is stuff that's not going to all get shipped off to Asia. This is stuff that's going to be happening all over the world, including Asia, of course, but here too, that engineering, science, math, and technical skills are going to be applied to, you know, making the world, you know, more livable, and at the same time, you know, you can make a good living doing that. That message is out there, and I think it's really important right now to be educating kids who are making career choices, you know, as early as, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, to kind of make them go, oh, that's kind of cool, I want to do that, and sort of get that association that the science is fun, that people have passion for it, that it can help the world. And a show like this, and at least in my mind, or a show like MythBusters, you know, kind of humanizes it, and that's, you know, that's really important. And that, to me, that was just like, that was my motivation. And it has just been like, I've been blown away by the response. I mean, I got thousands, not exaggerating, of emails and Facebook stuff from people, kids, parents, teachers. And, you know, it's funny because I don't think our show was all that much about front-up science. You know, the science is treated pretty superficially and pretty quickly. But I think it got people talking. So circling back, you know, if I could ever figure out some other TV way of doing that, one way or the other, before, in front of the camera or behind the camera, I would do it, because I think it's a very powerful media for getting, you know, cool stuff in front of a lot of people.
John, I wish you would do a show that was basically the colony without all the other stuff around it, because
do you think that'd
someone
be watchable?
Like me, I'm a pretty young individual, and like most young people, I don't have the skills that people your age or the rest of the guys on this show would have.
Yes, you do. That's the thing. You do. You do. Say it.
I mean, the thing is I can't solder. I can't weld. But it would be great if someone could show you how to do it. You know, it'd be like, here's...
Well, that's the thing. That's it. I think what you would show people is, yes, you can. I'll tell you what.
Like, when all the cards are down, here's how you do it.
Yeah. You know, and if you have to figure it out, you can figure it out. I'll tell you something that was really weird. So, you know, my... spoiler alert, in case anybody hasn't seen the show, but my wife showed up for the last two episodes, which was just totally blew me away. But, so it was really fun. She's my really... I love her in every possible, you know, she's my great friend and coworker and wonderful lady. And it was so much fun having her there. What was fun is since we've been back, you know, I'd say I'm a pretty handy person. I can figure stuff out, and I've always done that. And, you know, a lot of geeks are. But I always had this thing in my brain that, you know, there would be things I would look at, like a car or something, and I would go, I can't figure that out. And I wouldn't do it. Since the colony... there is just absolutely nothing. You know, I just kind of go, what's the worst that can happen? You know, I have to. It'll be just broken a little worse, and I'll ask a professional. So all of a sudden, I guess I can try that. That sort of muscle that keeps the thing you just said, like, I don't know how to weld. Well, you know what? I bought a welder. I mean, well, I do know how to weld, and this was before the colony, but I just bought a welder and said, how hard can it be? And you screw up a lot of metal, and then all of a sudden it goes, oh, that's how it works. And so that attitude, I now am so much more, since the colony, so much more, like, willing to, you know, roll up sleeves and dig into, you know, whatever hardware, software mess, and kind of with the attitude that, well, you know, I'll either figure it out or I can ask somebody after I screw it up. It's been really fun, and it's good, especially in a bad economy, because we end up saving a lot of money for, you know, doing it ourselves. It isn't always pretty, but you can usually figure stuff out.
It's kind of like Linux, anyway, huh? Get your hands dirty, dig down, get into it, and make the most out of a small amount of things that you have.
Ooh, I'm supposed to relate this all back to Linux. I did try to get that. So, here's a computer thing. So if you look at the introduction and stuff, I'm listed as computer engineer. So... the whole interview process. So it actually happened. It started about this time exactly a year ago this week. And what had happened? It was pretty kind of groovy, hippie groovy stuff. Is I blog every night on MySpace. Sorry about that, but that's where I started. I started after my son passed away. blog.myspace.com/JohnCone, and I was talking to my wife and I was telling her I really wanted to take my student, you know, my outreach to kids to another level. And she just said, you know, John, just put it out there in the cosmos. Put your intentions out there. So one night I blogged about it. And, you know, nobody reads my blog, so it wasn't that. But it was just sort of putting your intentions out. And the next day I get this call from this casting agency in Hollywood, you know, because they'd seen me on Google, I guess. And I look like a crazy scientist. And so this whole process started this time. Last year, and through this whole thing, you know, we had to figure out where was I going with this? I forgot. Linux. We had to figure out, you know, how was I, you know, what was everybody's skill? So they evidently had canvassed around the country. They supposedly interviewed thousands of people, which was kind of weird, because when you were all sitting around, the 10 of us looking at each other going, we're the best you could do? But they asked for a lot of people, and then we'd go through, and we did video interviews and essays, and then they called us out there, a fairly large group of people, and they made us do physicals and psychological batteries and then skills tests, and then they winnowed it down, and they ended up with us. Well, I was chosen because I was the computer engineer. And they kept asking me, so what would you do with computer and this kind of thing? So I made up all this stuff that I would do, and I told them I would only use Linux. See, I said Linux. And, of course, I show up on set. Show up on set is an understatement. we got, well, I'll tell you about how we ended up on getting on the set, but when I got there, there were no computers. I was like, wait a minute, I'm a computer engineer. And so it was really interesting, because what I thought I was going to be doing there, I had some sort of, in my mind, some cross between Gilligan's Island and, you know, Enemy of the State, you know, something where I'd have like really sophisticated computers and I'd be pretending to make things that would, you know, get into the computer thing and hack. I don't know what I was thinking. Well, there were no computers, and that's why all of a sudden I went, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. So my point is that, what is my point? My point is that as much as I was hoping that there would be more of a computer element, it turned out to be really fun that I ended up having to go back to, like, my high school hacking to actually be useful. One computer story, I did actually, you know, so they had this huge warehouse, and it is that warehouse in other, you know, at other times is used as a set for other movies, like Blades of Glory, you know, the Will Ferrell movie was filmed there and stuff. So they actually had to, you know, it was fairly neat, and they came in and they put a bunch of junk in there for us. And but at one point, I actually found a couple of computer carcasses, which weren't part of what they had put in there. They were actually, there used to be a place that made crack pipes, actually. It was like a glass-blowing place. And they had two computer carcasses, and between them, I was able to get something working, and that was kind of fun. But I found a wireless card. And it was busted, and I had, not that badly busted, had an antenna. And so finally one night I found a wireless, you know, there was an unlocked wireless SysID, you know, I found on there, and I got on the internet, and I was like, wow, because it would have been so nice to have the internet to, like, look up components and stuff. But it was about 11 o'clock at night. And one of the production guys came by, and let me think about this. So I didn't look around. I just got up to Google, and I said, okay. And the next day, I took out the card and handed it to him, and I said, look, I just proved that I could do it. You know, we were all so much in the game that we didn't want to violate, we didn't want to cheat. You know, that would have been cheating. And the really cool thing is if I had kept it a secret and I had persisted and used this computer, I would have actually blown the surprise. I would have known that my wife was coming. But as it turned out, I turned this thing into them. They always suspected that I had, you know, somehow figured this out, but I hadn't. I had just gotten to the point I could prove to myself I could get on the internet, and then I went, that sort of violated the rules. So I turned it in. But that was as close as I got. But unfortunately, it was Windows 98. It was pretty ugly.
Yeah, sounds pretty rough.
John, a question.
Yes, sir.
I watched a handful of the shows. My daughter watched all the shows. So one thing that really crossed my mind, and I think you touched on this a little bit, had me curious, is all the main people on there were just regular people, they weren't actors. Did you find it difficult to maintain a realistic impression of the situation that you were in, given the fact that, you know, right around the corner or a half a mile away, civilization was going on as you know it, and that in reality, you know, nothing has changed. You were in an artificial situation.
That's the second most common question. I think that's really cool. So the answer is really kind of complicated, because no one ever, even in the heat of these really intense scenes, forgot the fact that, you know, we could walk out the out the front door. There was a beer distributor, you know, right across the street. You know, we could walk downtown in a quarter of a mile. You know, no one ever forgot that. So we never lost track of that. We lost track of what day it was and everything else. But at the same time, I can't really speak to what everybody was thinking, but I can tell you, certainly from my own view and from what I could see of my friends there, is we were all so vested in this. One, emotionally, we wanted it to work. And we knew what the constraints were. You know, we weren't getting paid a lot. There was no competition. It wasn't like we were going to get a prize. We were getting I don't think I can say, but we were like minimum wage kind of numbers. So it wasn't, nobody was in it for anything other than this is cool. And everybody was so into the whole idea, and it was pretty easy to be into the idea because we truly were struggling to, you know, I mean, hydration, just keeping enough water, managing the water was a week a day problem, and we ended up having to constrain ourselves, and you would feel it. We were eating, you know, not enough food, and it was very poor quality food. You know, like Johnny V and Michael each lost about 30 pounds. I lost 12 pounds, and I'm a pretty skinny guy. We were sleep deprived. We were getting woken up much more often than the show showed, you know, by, you know, people banging on the doors or throwing rocks through things or stealing, you know, making something waking us up every couple of nights. And the personal tension of being inside there with these kind of weird things happening, it felt real. So it's hard to explain that while everyone knew it wasn't real, you didn't have to make up the fact that you were tired, hungry, thirsty, dirty as sin. We were just, you know, the hygiene was just horrible, pissed off at your coworkers, you know, so it was very real. In that sense, you didn't have to fake any of that. And even when these kind of scripted things where they were scripted on the part of the actors, they weren't scripted on our part, you know, these parts where bad guys would come or good guys would come and beg for stuff or whatever else, even though we knew that those guys were actors, the scenes were felt very real. I mean, when the bad guys would come in and they would, you know, punch us or steal stuff like that, we'd get truly angry. There was just no, I mean, you'd work really hard. Like, let me give you for instance. So when Andre and Liz came in, we had spent a lot of work trying to get water up into this solar water heater. We had to, you know, pedal, we made, John V and Amy had made this pedal power thing to take the water up to the roof, so we had gravity feed. We had 35 gallons of water there. That's half of what, you know, one water run a mile to the river. Liz went in there and intentionally drained the water through there, just let it run out. And that was a lot of work. We were pissed. I don't care if she was a well-paid actress or, you know, I didn't care who she was. She had just, you know, wasted a bunch of our effort. And we were all mad. So you didn't have to make it up. So it was very easy to remain in the world. We didn't ever lose sight. Nobody got delusional. And there were a couple places where, you know, like, I remember when George was taken, Vlad was getting a little bit steamed up, and we were all looking at him going, it's a TV show. But at the same time, nobody was blowing it off. Everybody took it really seriously. And in some sense, to me, it was like a game. You know, it became like a drama, like, what's going to happen next? And you just got immersed in it, like this weird role playing thing. It's very hard to describe, but it was absolutely real. And
I guess what
nobody
that brings
gave up.
Go ahead, guys.
I guess it goes back to, you know, people don't realize that, you know, when you don't have like the corner convenience store, and you have to provide basic necessities, water and food for yourself, how much of your time is actually occupied by, you know, just going out and loading up on water and bringing it back and boiling it or purifying whatever method you're using.
I think water turned out to be a real surprise to me. It's just how big it, I remember, you know, because we got there and we had scavenged some water. The way the whole thing started is, you know, we were in a hotel kind of chilling for the first week where they were, you know, doing some training, and, you know, we would come out of our rooms every once in a while, and they would feed us and stuff, but then they'd put us back in our room, essentially locking us in. We didn't have keys, so we couldn't come out. So that was kind of weird. And then one morning, they came and said, hey, you know, come on down, and from that point on, we were on. They kept us awake for about 36 hours, and then they dumped us into this old abandoned shopping center. It was an old Montgomery Ward, and said, go. And, you know, we were kind of like, what? They said, go in there and grab as much as you can until you can't. And we were like, what? And as soon as we went in there, guys in motorcycles came in and started trying to hit us with baseball bats. We were like, what? We scavenged some water, and then we ended up walking down the LA River, they said, well, just walk a little bit until you get to, you know, you'll know when to stop. And I had in my mind that we would go, you know, a couple hundred yards, and we'd find this little Gilligan's Island set. Well, we walked, I think it was probably about 6.5 hours, you know, through really bad heat, people throwing stuff at us. It was just, you know, this was the first day. We were sleep-deprived, hadn't eaten. It was just crazy. You know, we finally got there, and you know, it really kept you in the mood. It really did. It was pretty phenomenal. But anyway.
Well, you know what? You mentioned before about the hygiene issue.
Yeah.
And this is, and I know that this is an odd subject, and I don't know if anybody else wants to hear about it, but I'm fascinated by this. What did you do for your hygiene needs? Like, no one ever asks these really personal questions, and I hope you don't mind, but, you know, what did you do?
Are you kidding? I appeared naked as part of that on national TV.
Right.
I have no pride.
What did you do for your toilet facilities? What did you blow your nose on? What did you wipe your ass with? Did you guys have any facilities for, you know, things that we all might take for granted, like brushing your teeth once in a while?
Soap or anything like that? So, like the water issue that I was just talking about, you know, we ended up having to walk back to the river, or sometimes we would get an assist, but for the most part we'd walk back or bicycle back. John V made a really cool bike cart until that got stolen by, I think, actually real bad guys, not fake bad guys. But we had to pull that water back about a mile from, we were over the 4th Street Bridge and stuff. And so when we could pull back, I don't know, maybe 65 gallons of water a pop, water became so precious that washing with it became a luxury. So even though we made this nice hot shower, we couldn't really afford to do that. So we got dirtier and dirtier. And, you know, the hygiene started, you know, we would try to keep our dishes clean because we couldn't afford to get really sick. And, you know, believe it or not, nobody got really bad intestinal bugs. That was what our really worst fear was, because there were toilets in the building, but there was no water. And, you know, if you know how a toilet works, it works by a siphon. So you have to fill up the bowl. So if you think about the bowl of a toilet, you know, you sit on there, do your business, and then when you flush it, what it does is it floods water into that bowl, and it creates a siphon. You know, it pushes down, and there's an S-curve, and it actually allows this thing to start a siphon, and it empties the bowl until the water's gone. Okay, well, when there's no water, whatever you put in that bowl just stays there. So what we would have to do is take water and, you know, fill the, you know, after a while. So we sort of had a, if it's brown, flush it down. If it's yellow, let it mellow kind of thing. Well, with 10 people, one toilet. Well, at one point we had as many as 3 toilets working. But one by one, they would get plugged up. We didn't have a plunger. And the water that we were using, you know, we obviously weren't going to use drinking water to flush the toilet, so we would use our dishwater. But water then became so constrained that we couldn't flush very often. Not to put too fine a point on it, 10 people, bad diet, you know, that became really hard. So we had one toilet. How much detail do you want? Is this where you want to go? So we had one toilet that was more private, let's say. You know, that you could actually shut a door. It was one of the few places you weren't on camera. And then the other one was, we just had sort of a sheet around it. And, you know, at that point, it was kind of interesting because 10 strangers, we slept 5 in one bed, eventually 4 in one bed and 4 in the other, and Mike went off somewhere else. So we, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of privacy. And then the toilet stuff became pretty gross. And then when we would, you know, flushing, occasionally, because you didn't have a plunger or anything like that, one by one the toilets would fail, and we only had one working at the end. But at the end, we became very constrained on water. We were only able to go out to get water. We had two means of getting water. One was to you know, somehow get to the river, walk, ride, and the other one was that Michael and Johnny V had rigged up a kind of a cool conduit system so that when it rained, you know, we could capture the water. And that was really a godsend because we could get, you know, it was filthy water, but it was no worse than the L.A. River. And then we could run it through our filtration system, which was a charcoal sand filter, and then oil the stuff to make it safe. The problem is it only rained three times and only twice after, you know, we rigged up that system. So we, as we got towards the end, they intentionally made it harder and harder for us to get water. I mean, the mindset was things in were deteriorating in L.A. You know, there were these gangs of roving guys. There was less and less stuff available, and so things had really come to a head. And because the violence was up, we couldn't go out, and the water was blocked. So for the last 2 weeks, the last 10 days, we got by with like 18 gallons of water. Is that right? Something like that, less than 20. So we were, you know, we were literally in the process of dying from, you know, from dehydration. You can only go 3 days without water, and your body starts to, you know, you get really, you really want to know all this? You get really constipated, you know, you stop peeing. It got pretty pretty intense, and we lacked water to flush the toilet, so we started, in answer to your question, we started using plastic bags. You want to? How far do you want to go with it? That, you know, one of the things.
I'll keep it coming. This is the kind of stuff that our listeners really love. So, I'm completely.
Yeah, if they can put up with Linux,
if
they can hack the kernel, they can put up with a little poor hygiene.
Yeah.
But you know, it's funny as that part became really easy. It wasn't a hardship. I mean, it was everything like that was kind of a cool challenge. But you know, we were on such bad diet, such bad water. You know, we were really, our bodies were very weak. When my wife showed up, I mean, she was just like horrified how skinny I was. And I remember, as a matter of fact, I just saw Michael, and he's still really skinny. And he lost 30 pounds. 30 pounds, that's a lot in 2 months. And I think it, you know, hygiene was also, you know, we couldn't wash our, we ended up washing our clothes less, you know, we initially did it about once a week, and we would use, we had some soap, and then we ended up, Allison and I made soap from lye and fat that we, you know, we had fat from animal stuff, and we used that very, very harsh soap to wash. But then even that water we would refilter and use to flush the toilets or water the plants. But eventually we didn't even have enough water to do that, so our clothes got dirtier and dirtier. I was voted the dirtiest colonist, which is saying something there. I was filthy. I was really black.
Yeah, you guys look like a bunch of homeless people by the end of the show.
Well, I'll tell you a story on that. But we were pretty dirty, and we smelled really bad. But what was funny is we got pretty used to it. And as I guess a homeless person must do, you just kind of your own stench, you start to get used to it. And I remember, you know, the camera guys wouldn't stand so close to us. But early on, it was actually, you know, day three or four, it was our first thing. We hadn't bathed. You know, we had been in the L.A. River wet, had dried, slept in the same clothes because we didn't have anything other than the clothes we wore. And we found stuff. We were picking through stuff like real homeless people's clothes. We'd bring them back and wash them. Because there's caches, you know, as we would go out, you know, there would be real stuff that we would go through. We'd find, you know, shopping carts, and we'd take them. And we tried never to take something that somebody was using, obviously. But for the most part, we were sleeping in the same clothes. And we were so filthy the first couple of days that the first rainfall, there were three total rainfalls, two that we had were prepared for. But this first one, everybody was so excited by the rainfall that they went out with buckets and stuff into the front yard. I was like, no way, I'm getting clean. So I ran out, we had this small backyard, tossed my clothes down, stripped off, you know, the only thing that we had, we were wearing mics, we were all wireless mics, so tossed my wireless mic down. This was before I realized how, you know, instrumented the whole place was with TVs and stuff like that, you know, with cameras and stuff. I ran outside and was just like soaking in the rain, just trying to get clean. Just the stench was coming off of me. And I turned around, and there was this $100,000 camera pointing right at me. And I went, you wouldn't. And I quickly picked up this plastic sheet. Anyway, so I didn't know anything about this until, you know, I thought there's no way they'd put that on Discovery Channel. Well, the day before the show aired, the first show, July 21st, I got a call from the New York Times. And I was so excited. I was thinking, oh, my mom and dad are going to be so proud, interviewed by the New York Times. I'm going to do like what I'm doing here, talking about how important science is for kids and what my motivations are. And I was just all prepared for it. All the guy wanted to talk about, he said, tell me about the last 45 seconds of the first episode. And I said, well, I haven't seen it. And he said, well, I have. And I said, what is the last 45 seconds? He said, you really don't know? And I went, all of a sudden I went, oh, no. So the last 45 seconds is me very tastefully pixelated, but just completely bare-ass naked. And, you know, I didn't do it for show, but eventually, you know, I just started hamming it up because I didn't think they would really put it on there. But it really felt great just to be wet. But, I that was an unpracticed, like, I can't stand the stench from me. Okay, so you mentioned about what it was like being homeless. So the last episode, we run out there, we've gotten on the truck. You know, the last episode was a little weird for me, but you know, finally they said, that's a wrap. And we're all looking at each other going, what? And they bring out bags of junk food. We completely devour it. They take us back to a couple of interviews, and then they took us back to the hotel. Diane, my wife's interviews were later, so I got back there first. And I think it was Michael Raines and I. They dropped us off. They basically just dropped us off at a fancy hotel, the Biltmore Hotel. And, I mean, the doorman did not want to let me in. I really looked that bad. And I kind of was going, well, you know, I mean, one of the production assistants was with us, and so they managed to finesse it. But I was just thinking about, well, of course I would say that I was sane. You know, I was just thinking about what it would be really like to fall off and really look like that. How would you ever get back into, you know, into society? It really felt like that because we were filthy. I have a picture of my second bath and the three rings of dirt that are from there. And I look at that and I just laugh because I was just black. It was really something. I didn't feel clean for a week. But I tell you what, now when I can go into a nice clean bathroom, turn on hot water, I do not take that for granted. I still do not take that for granted.
People don't realize how good they have it.
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of things. Food. I mean, we ended up eating rats and pigeons, and I ate cat food, and I'm a vegetarian. You know, that was pretty weird. We ate animal grain, you know, feed. We ate and the other kind of stuff we had, like hominy and sauerkraut, none of which I will ever eat again. So a good burrito. I really missed only a few things. I missed my family, and I missed Mexican food, and I missed beer. And other than that, I didn't miss anything. But those things, I just absolutely, I always loved my family, but boy, do I really love them now. Mexican food and beer are also something I enjoy a lot more now.
So what did you use for paper products?
Oh, you asked about toilet paper. Go
ahead.
We had a fair number of, you know, there was various stuff around in the warehouse. So there was, you know, paper towels. There was newspaper. There was a bunch of old drapes, which we forced into service. Now, of course, you know, from the toilet paper standpoint, you had to be careful what you put down the drain because there was no, you know, clogging was verboten. You couldn't do that. At one point, Lalani and some other people actually made some paper. I remember they shredded some paper and tried to dry it, but that was too much work. So they shredded cloth that we had found. There was just big rolls of cloth. The factory actually had some sort of cloth bag making, so we used that. What else did we have? But a lot of newspaper, or there were some old magazines/manuals and stuff that we would shred. But we quickly ran out of paper towels and stuff like that, so we ended up washing the paper towels and drying them. It was funny because what they would do, it was a little confusing to us, and we finally kind of caught on, but there would be things that were consumable. So we had, you know, paper towels, for example, but when we'd run out of them, we'd look to them and we'd say, hey, where are more paper towels? They go, well, I don't know. So the idea was there were things around like propane. We had propane for a while that we could use to boil the water to purify it because you had to do that. And when we'd run out, we ran out, or gasoline, or so the paper products, we actually, in hindsight, we went through without thinking about. And you know, toilet paper was, that was a big deal, not having toilet paper and having to improvise. It's a little inconvenient. Nature sort of
little chafing going on
took
there.
Care of it. It wasn't as often a problem as you might think, given the diet that we were on.
You know what I'm really curious about is I have noticed, like, I here at home live with my wife and daughter, and I have made the observation that women tend to use about 17 times more paper products than I do during the normal course of a week or a month or whatever time period. Did you find the same to be true there on the show? I mean, you had several women there, and I can only imagine, based on my experience, that you know they tend to go through that sort of.
I will just say that everybody took this seriously. If anything, the women, you know, I think the women on the show were amazing, and I think that they took the conservation stuff much more seriously than the guys did. The women, you know, that's one thing that I found a little bit strange about the show is that, watching it, I don't think the women were portrayed as to be as innovative and responsible and leading as much as they actually were. And I think that some of the interpersonal stuff sort of overshadowed that. But I think actually, when I think about it, you know, Allison and Amy, actually all of them, Leilani, were much more mindful about the resources than we were, we guys. So I think everybody, there was never a case, really, that anybody used more than their fair share or didn't there were times that people would, like Michael, would complain that we didn't have enough food, but he'd stay with the, you know, nobody would ever go steal food and do it, you know, eat it themselves, or, you know, use more than their share of water or paper products. It just wasn't done. And, you know, it's funny because no matter how bad the interpersonal stuff would get, because there were some real tensions between some of the people, nobody would disrespect the communal property. It was pretty cool in that, because I think everybody realized that, you know, even though it was contrived and we could walk outside if we needed to, that wasn't what any of us were going to do, and so we had to live with what we had. And if anybody overindulged or wasted or anything like that, everybody would feel it. And that's pretty amazing that no matter how bad the atmosphere could get on interpersonal planes, nobody ever screwed up intentionally or unintentionally screwed up on the resource stuff. I thought that was really pretty cool, and I think the women actually exerted more leadership. So I think they stayed within their. We never had quotas on paper products, but let me tell you, we had two occasions where these traders would come by. And toilet paper was high on the list. I would rather have toilet paper than gasoline. You know, that was basically where we had to make choices like that. But that was pretty funny.
Well, I highly recommend people to check out the show if they haven't seen it already. So, John, let me ask you, how'd you get into computers in the very beginning?
Well, let's see. I was reading all of your bios, and I was trying to think of when was the first time. I remember the first time I had real hands-on access to a computer was a Wang programmable calculator. It must have been in, was it ninth grade? So that would have been, so I'm 50, so that would have been 74, 73, which is relatively late, but I think I think I had messed around with computers in Boy Scouts. We'd seen some things. We'd gone to Exxon. Was that before then? No, it was about then. And we had this Wang programmable calculator. And then we had a dial-up system, a time-sharing system for the CDC 770. I remember that. And we could call in and you could write simple basic programs. But then my friends and I started really getting excited about this stuff, and I became sort of a computer and phone freak for a while, and we ended up doing a lot of dumpster diving. We ended up finding, it was kind of a quirk of Control Data's job control language, that some jobs that had to run authorized would have passwords in the job control headers. And so if you would go through these big printouts, you could actually find those. And if you could find those, you could parlay them. It was really a terrible security system because, you know, an account at a certain authority level sometimes had to run stuff at a higher authority level, so it would have these scripts in it that had a higher authority. And the job control scripts usually were the same as the interactive, you know, the timeshare, you know, TSO kind of thing. And so we would be able to parlay that into getting, you know, fairly high access in this thing. And we'd borrowing TI terminals with thermal paper printers and acoustic modems, where you put the phone into the little suction cups, and at 300 baud, and we would wreak all sorts of havoc. We were actually able to bring the computer down. And the funny thing is, they didn't really catch on to the fact how we were able to find these passwords. So they would change them, but we would know where they had changed them. So as long as we could get on, we could keep finding our way back in, and it was really fun. And I remember being able to find out, and I guess since all of the teachers at this point probably are retired or dead, it's okay to say this, but we were able to find out, like, from that, where the school district was spending its money. We were trying to buy a laser for $300, I remember that, and they wouldn't give us the money, but we found out that they had spent, I think it was $15,000, which was a princely sum back then, on a upgrade to the running track, and we were able to use this fact in our argument without revealing our source. And it was, and we never got our laser, but it was pretty cool. We were doing all sorts of, we felt very justified in doing this hacking. And then from there, what did we start doing? I don't know. I start building little computers. I'm trying to think of the first real computer that I ever had. God, it was probably, you know, we had plenty of timeshare stuff. I'm trying to think of the first computer that I owned. You know, I had programmable calculators and stuff, but when I finally went to MIT, we learned on, you know, I guess that was the first time that I actually had computers that were my own. And we were learning on Lisp machines, you know. That was the first formal training I ever had on them, and they were all named after, I learned on Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin. They were wire-wrapped computers from a company called Symbolics. They were pretty cool. And then, what was funny is I never really liked computers. I mean, I thought that they were interesting tools, and I was my interest was in materials science and physics. So when I was at MIT, I was a materials kind of guy, and like Madonna, I guess. And I loved MIT. I went through there and took my junior year overseas in Austin and came back and got. Just the only job I've ever interviewed for is the one I basically have now. I met I had a friend from Texas who was going. My dogs are reminding me that.
What about?
Sorry about that. I had a friend, just a platonic friend from Texas, who she had moved up here, and I used to come visit her in Vermont. And through that, I found out that there was an IBM site up here. So when I was ready to graduate, I said, hey, let me come up. I just walked in for an interview. I came up specifically for the interview, now that I think of it. But anyway, I basically still have that same job, and that was 28 years ago. And wow. I took a job. Actually, my job was to do laser processing of thin films, like to cut thin resistors. And I started on that thing, and the laser was really fun. I loved that thing, and about 2 weeks into that job, the laser broke down, and they said, well, while we're waiting for it to get repaired, you know, can you handle this software problem? And it had to do with it was a shapes checking, you know, kind of a ground rules checking problem with chips. And this was back in the time where you ran things in, this was right above, I skipped a whole bunch of stuff about, when I was in high school, I was taking classes at Rice University in Houston, and I was using punch cards at that point. But by the time I got to MIT, we were past punch cards, and I worked at Texas Instruments and a couple of other places, you know. So computers had advanced to the point where it was just above punch cards. You were still writing in job control language, but you actually could type it in on a screen. And so I started doing that, and I remember telling my boss, I hate computers. And then slowly by slowly, I got kind of hooked on coding. And the rest, as they say, is history. That was 1981. And then I kind of started writing software for on big computers to help design chips. And then that my hobby, I was very interested. I do a lot of circuit hacking at home. And then I guess the real thing was when you started having embedded processors like 8052s and 8081s, I started finding that it was a really cool thing is to be able to write code on something that you could buy for 75 cents. And when I went to grad school in 88 at Carnegie Mellon, I started doing a bunch of work with, well, I was doing work with the arts and at MIT also at the, what's now the Media Lab. It was called the Architecture Machine. We did some embedded computing stuff then. And then at when I was at in grad school doing computer-aided design stuff, I did a lot of embedded computing for the art department there, doing kind of weird performance art pieces that were, you know, embedded 8051s and stuff. And I just am really hooked on building stuff out of very simple computers. And so now I am, you know, an old and senior guy at IBM, and I program supercomputers, and I program the tiniest, you know, 8-bit, you know, 75-cent microcontrollers. And I love the fact, you know, getting back to the Linux theme, I love the fact that you can, you know, get a chipset that costs less than $5 that you can run Linux on, and you can also run it on a, you know, $20 million supercomputer, and the same code. I got to, you know, from a hobbyist standpoint, I really like these, like, small embedded Linux things. Like, I'm a member of a community that does, that hacks Linux's network storage attached devices, these things called slugs. So I'm running Debian on those, and that's pretty cool. And I love writing things on the smallest possible footprint. I don't know why. But I think it's writing.
What are you coding mostly, C?
Anything. Assembler, if I have to, C, C++, Java, Perl, Python. I just fell in love with Python. It's the most horrible language, but for something about it, it's like, you know, cotton candy or something. You know you shouldn't eat it, but it's so easy to write stuff in, and there's so much cool stuff. And I've been doing a lot of web scraping. Like, for example, I had a thing where one of these little slugs, it was a Linksys, was it a router, or was it a storage attached thing? It was a storage attached thing. I wrote a bunch of embedded Python stuff on that checked my blog and blinks the lights in the tower. I live in an old schoolhouse, so the lights in the tower blink if anybody ever reads my blog.
That's pretty cool.
Python running on a small, you know, embedded Linux thing that's been subverted from its original purpose. I take great pride in that. So let's see. I guess, what do I write mostly in? I even write, you know, embedded BASIC. I'm not proud on these small machines. Mostly C derivatives, I guess. I would say I'm not a great programmer. You know, it's just like I'm a poor speller. I'm not a gifted, but I'm a good architect, and I feel like I'm a pretty proficient hacker. Any language, any platform, any application. I just don't do things that are pretty. And so I've surrounded myself with people who are very good at the pretty part. So I like the challenge.
It's pretty amazing what you could do. I mean, like you said, you know, Linux runs on anything. It runs on everything from a toaster to a supercluster, you know.
I love that. I totally love that. As a matter of fact, what I'm working on now, if I talk about my work, I can't say anything confidential, and I don't want it to sound like an ad campaign, but I am so jazzed about the stuff that I'm doing right now. Is that getting into dangerous territory if I talk about it in the abstract?
No, you can talk about it.
So, can I say where I work?
We have it on our website.
Oh, cool. So IBM...
Yeah, you can say anything you want on this show, John.
So anyway, I've been at IBM for 28 years, and I'm a fellow, which makes me, you know, I guess there are about 65 people at my rank. And so I've got a lot of leeway in what I do. And recently the company has come up with this thing they call Smarter Planet. And what I really like about it is really about how IT, and many other companies are doing this too, so, but I like the way my company is going about it. The whole idea is how do you use information technology to help the planet, you know, be smarter, you know, in terms of use of resources, and it's a lot about analytics and things like that. So how do you use electricity more wisely, how do you use water more wisely, and it's not, you know, the company is good-spirited and stuff, but it's not just because, gee, you know, it's nice public, you know, public relations. It's because there's huge money to be made for us and for our customers in saving money, you know, and resources and making better decisions on logistics, transport, financial decisions, the water, power usage. So it's a really exciting thing. And for me, you know, I really, on the show, I really enjoyed making green inventions. You know, we made that solar tracker. We made water heater, water purifier, and the gasifier. Got me really psyched about green inventing. And now in my company, this Smarter Planet stuff is more than just green, but it's at its core, it's about using information and analytics to make better decisions about the use of resources. So it really lines up with my personal karma, and it's also very easy to convince, you know, kids get it, parents get it, and stuff like that. Well, part of this, you know, the whole idea is if you're going to make more informed decisions in the world, you've got to have instrumentation. So the whole idea is that we've got sensors and actuators, and the sensors are feeding data up, and you're using the analytics, and you're making decisions, and you're telling those actuators. Well, these sensors and actuators all run on these little tiny embedded processors, and, you know, some of them are embedded Linux, some of them are even, you know, Mr. Coffee class machines, you know, below the operating system level kind of machines. So we're looking at how do you connect, and I think one of the terms of art right now is an Internet of Things. You know, we're looking at stuff where you're going to have hundreds of millions of processors. Each one of them has a MAC address. You know, I'm working in these weird wireless world. Like, there's a protocol called 6LoWPAN. It's like a short range wireless. It's like Zigbee, only it's all IP based. And the thought that, you know, your toaster and your refrigerator and your car and everything has a MAC address, I just love it. You know, the fact that you can write, like you were saying, at the same level, using the same abstractions, you know, the same language constructs, the same operating system constructs, the same networking constructs from the biggest supercomputer that we make, or the biggest network of supercomputers that we make, all the way down to the friggin' thing in your light switch, just boggles my mind. But if you don't have a uniform way of doing it, the world can get a lot more complicated, a lot more dangerous. So I used to be a hacker. I was a phone hobbyist, and I got caught. So I even have an FBI record for this. And I come at this new thing that I'm doing with that kind of mindset. Is if I were up to no good, the thought of having all these embedded processors out there with kind of ad hoc security and stuff like that, you know, just the provisioning, what firmware is that running, or can I reflash that thing and subvert its meaning? You know, I think very much about, you know, what either intentional or unintentional bad could happen by not managing that stuff very well. And so it's really interesting. So my day job is now thinking a lot about these, you know, small embedded processes and how they interact and how you maintain them and provision them and secure them and stuff. And it's really cool because I'm getting paid to be, you know, at IBM to do my hobby, which is pretty cool. And, you know, short of going back on TV and eating rats, it's about the best thing you could actually ask for. It's pretty cool. Was that too salesy? I didn't mean it to be salesy. It was
not at all.
Really, yeah. But anyway, I think it's a really... Let me just say in general, it's a really good time to be a geek because there's so much cool stuff going on. And there's this... You know, I've lived for 40 years, or 30 years almost, in IBM... You know, and watching how Moore's Law, or what we call it, Dennard's Law, but, you know, how scaling, silicon performance scaling, has driven computer, you know, IT, and all of a sudden that's really stopped. And so, while that could be a disaster in one sense, it's causing innovation in so many other planes to start blossoming. So I'm excited. I kind of wish I was starting my career right now.
Yeah, it's amazing what some of these embedded devices can do. I mean, you look at like the phone market it's pretty incredible, or you know, similar type of devices, you know, running on like ARM architecture. It's pretty powerful stuff. You know, these little handheld devices have more power than, you know, those old computers that would take up several rooms, you know.
And it's amazing when you think about, if you network them and you actually have workload that you can put down on there, think of what you're actually carrying around in your... Exactly. I mean, you know, there's hundreds of millions of those things out there. That's a lot of horsepower, for good or evil, right? You know, that's pretty... I think it's really cool. But, I don't know. I like... as a matter of fact, you know, Christmas is coming, and a lot of my gifts that I'm going to get, or you know, Hanukkah, Christmas, whatever you call it, or that my sons are getting, involve embedded processors. Can you believe it? My son and I, my oldest son, is doing. He's a film major at Pratt, a really cool guy, Max, and he's doing a bunch of physical computing. And so we've been collaborating on a project. We've been hooking an EEG, you know, like a brain sensor, up to a synthesizer. So he's doing I did the hardware hacking to get his Mac to talk to this peripheral, you know, and that was all a combination of Python and stuff. And then he writes in a language, it's a systems language called Max, MSP. And so at Thanksgiving, he and I, you know, stayed up a bunch of late nights and hacked between, you know, this EEG sensor and his audio synthesizer, video synthesizer thing, and he's been working on it, and so he now has a synthesizer that you can play by thinking, which is pretty cool. So again, embedded, it's running on a bunch of, you know, it's got some embedded processors in it, stuff like that. Or I'm a big MIT alum, and we have an alumni group here in Vermont, VOMIT, Vermont's own MIT club. Good name. But we built a giant 20-foot, you know, robotic, computer-controlled pneumatic pumpkin. You can find it on the web. I'll send you a picture. But it's got three embedded, you know, Arduino processors in it. I love combining computers with big, dangerous moving machines. I think that's my favorite thing.
So you're into that Burning Man stuff?
Yeah. Are you guys burners?
No, not me. I don't have time for that. I got two little kids.
Burning Man, if any of the guys who are listening ever have a chance to do it, it's if you don't know what it is, it's a festival out in the Nevada desert near Gerlach, Nevada, just about 90 miles out of Reno. And it's been going for more than 20 years. It started as a small, I think, a divorce party in Santa Monica is, I think, the story, but it's grown into a pretty big thing, and there were 50,000 people there this year, and it's an interesting combination. I mean, the whole premise is radical self-sufficiency, and you come out on this salt flat. It's a dry lake bed, you know, over 100 degrees during the day, 50s or 40s at night, and 50,000 freaks. You're not allowed to purchase anything. You're not allowed to advertise or sell anything. The only thing you can buy there, actually, is ice and espresso, which I think is pretty cool. And you have to bring everything. And so you need power, you have to bring a generator. If you want to bring, you have to bring all your food and all your water. You can buy ice, I guess. And the idea is to come and share, and people bring things and they gift, you know, so they bring stuff like... when my son Sam passed away, we make these small stones with his name, and you can look at them on samstones.org, and we would give those away, and people would come up and give you jewelry that they'd made, and it's just a kind of a cool gifting kind of environment. But then what's really interesting, there's a lot of drugs and nudity and stuff like that, which is interesting too, if you're like a 50-year-old geek. That's kind of an odd thing. But what's really cool about it is the mix of technology and art and self-expression. And so there is this huge culture of people building just amazing technological art that is all self-contained. It has to be self-powered by one way or another. A lot of stuff having to do with flame. Like, I made a flamethrower on the colony, and that's where I learned to do it at Burning Man. Just tons of computer-controlled flame and computer-controlled light. Everybody is lit up with, you know, electroluminescence or LEDs, and it's an all-night party for a week, and there's these giant raves, you know, a lot of techno music and stuff like that, and raves and stuff like that, and you see a bunch of guys like my age just dancing their heads off, you know, all night. This and then one of the other parts of the culture that's kind of part technology, part art, is there's this art car movement where people will make anything from, you know, single car, you know, pedal-powered vehicles that look like animals to huge floating, you know, almost like cruise boats with bars and music and stuff like that that looked, last year, there was this giant duck. I mean, I still can't believe that I actually saw it. It was the size of a, you know, four city buses, and it had a three layers and searchlight heads and a band playing on it, and it was just amazing. But this year was the first year that our small posse, we have a small group from, it's actually not from Vermont. I mean, some of us are from Vermont. We call ourselves Duane's World because the centerpiece is this guy named Duane. But we built our first art car, and it was a giant, it's called the Time Cycle, T-I-M-E Cycle, Time Cycle, because the theme this year was time. And it was a giant 20-foot-tall Ferris wheel mobile powered by a 40-horsepower diesel engine run by hydraulics. My friend Homer, who reminds me a little bit of Michael on the show, but Homer is just a mechanical genius. He built this thing from his head, built a scale model, and built this thing. And we built the whole thing in 40 days, took it apart, chipped it out there, and reassembled it. And it's just amazing. You know, you go around. I found some ski lift chairs, and there's three of those, and they go around in a 15-foot radius circle inside this 20-foot. These two 20-foot wheels that you can steer, and the thing is just bizarre. It's just huge. And I did the lighting, so there's computer-controlled, you know, LED ribbon lights that chase around and do different patterns on the wheels. And it's quite a sight, but it was really fun to have this thing. It's just, I'll never forget, you know, this Burning Man, you know, driving into the sunrise, you know, after being out on this thing all night, just watching the sunrise on the desert. It was just transcendent. It was amazing. And just the technology and the teamwork and the challenges that come up, you know, keeping the thing running just for the couple of days that it was out there was just amazing. But you really should check it out. Time Cycle, if you look it up, Time Cycle Burning Man, you'll see this vehicle. It's quite something. And we're you know, rebuilding it for this year, so it'll be, or next year, so it'll be a little bit easier to put together, more robust. The lights will be a little cooler. But if you ever have a chance, and you are at all drawn to things related to technology and you like people, it's really worth doing. And you know what? It's a lot like the colony, because it's filthy and you're dusty and everything else. And what's really funny is, since the colony, you know, the first year I went to Burning Man, I was like, oh man, this is uncomfortable, sleeping on the floor with, you know, dust storms and everything else. This year it felt like heaven, because I had just come back from the colony. Anyway, check it out.
We will. Thanks for the tip. Let me ask you, what are some of the projects that you try to get kids interested in from a technology standpoint? I looked up some of your bio stuff, and I saw that you were going around on tour talking to kids in schools and stuff and doing, like, demos. You seem to be doing some stuff for electricity and electrical-type stuff, like Tesla coils and whatnot. Well, what are some of the things that you think, you know, people can kids to get them interested?
Yeah, you know, one thing I'm very realizing that I haven't ever been very good about documenting. I've tried putting together a website and stuff, but I never really take the time to document. That's an important thing to do. I do one main show, which is something called Jolts and Volts, and I do it's kind of geared at probably fourth grade to seventh grade is the perfect place for it, and I just do this crazy mad scientist thing. If you Google John Cone IBM, you know, you see pictures of me, I'll be wearing a Technicolor, you know, like a tie-dye lab coat, and you'll be able to see me there kind of hanging out. And that basic talk is about experiential science, particularly electricity, and we go sort of from left to right, from microvolts to megavolts. So we have a theremin that the kids play, and it's a stage show, but I've done it for, you know, 10 kids in a classroom or 800 kids in a auditorium. I'm trying to get it geared a little bit more towards bigger, because I'm getting invites to, I do it all over the place now. It was just this local thing I did in my kids' schools. But then I do, you know, an EKG for millivolts. I do some robotics at volts. I do, you know, kid putting a tongue on a 9-volt battery, so some low-tech stuff, and then lighting steel wool with the same 9-volt battery. I have a potato gun that I light, you know, that I fire off inside with paper towels and Jacob's ladder and Van de Graaff generator and a fairly large Tesla coil, you know, about a 40-inch spark. What else do I have in that? But basically the shtick is, you know, going from small to big and, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting electricity. But I really go over the top, and it really works pretty well. I have some other shows that I do. I do a show called Inventors Like You. I haven't done it in a while, but that's about, you know, trying to get kids to realize that all inventors are not old, dead white guys. Now, given that I'm an old white guy, that probably doesn't, you know, but I usually do it with a younger woman or a minority, you know, somebody who doesn't look like the traditional scientist. And I've done a after-school program that my wife's helped me with. This has been quite a while since I've done this, but this was just sort of experiential science where the kids get to take a kit home, you know, that has magnets and chemicals and things like that. You know, fairly safe, but not too safe. But my main thing right now is this jolts and volts. But right now, you know, what I'm doing is I'm doing a lot of talking on the colony and relating that. I have kind of I went off on kind of a funny tangent starting last fall. Yeah, I guess about last fall, I started talking about the you know, the opportunity. I remember I sort of started this conversation with the opportunity that, you know, yeah, engineering has been kind of in the decline, engineering enrollment and decline to flat in the West, and doing okay in the East, you know, in terms of, you know, Asia and China, but still not even at the top, not enough to meet what I think is going to be a transitional demand as we shift from an oil economy. That's my belief. So I talked about, I have a talk that I do about what can you do to to get kids interested in science and engineering, and I started doing it at conferences in my field. So I did a kind of a minor conference, and then last February, actually just 2 weeks before I had to leave for the colony, as a matter of fact, I learned that was a funny thing, because I learned about that I was going to be on the colony only about 3 weeks before I learned that I officially was on it only 3 weeks before I had to show up, which was kind of an interesting conversation with my boss. But I remember I was giving a talk at a major, you know, one of the biggest conferences in my field on the need to do education outreach, and that was really fun, you know. So they had all these dry technical talks, and then I came out in tie-dye and with a Tesla coil and, you know, kind of did sort of a funny thing. So I do a lot of talking about the engineering, I don't want to call it an engineering crisis, I don't think that's helpful language, but, you know, the challenges of engineering and the opportunity that I was talking about with, you know, the coming sort of switch in, you know, I think kids are starting to understand that the connection between engineering and science and the good that it can do in the world, and what do we do to sort of take advantage of that moment. So I've been talking about that, and now I talk about that as a lead-in to, so what did I do about it? I went and spent 58 days in a rat-infested warehouse and ate rats, you know, and I talk about the colony. So I do a lot of talking about that, and I've probably spoken to getting 2,000, maybe almost 3,000 people about that at this point. So it's kind of a fun connection. It's a really cool opportunity that I've gotten to sort of take that passion for engineering outreach and my own geekiness and kind of combine it into something that I hope is getting you know, what might, if I can talk to everybody who might be listening to this, is if you're passionate about something, whether it's programming Linux, you know, stuff, doing robotics, whatever it is, it's so important that people, and kids in particular, see you as having fun and being passionate. Because, I mean, if you would all out there right now raise your hand, if you're a geek, I mean, you wouldn't be listening to this show if you weren't a geek. Well, if people recognize how much you love that, and you could somehow figure out how to show that part, that's the part that kids aren't seeing about engineering. They're seeing that it's really dry and dull and stuff, and it isn't, or you wouldn't be listening to this, right? So you got to sort of, you know, kind of ham it up and show them that love and show them what you could do with, you know, embedded processing. You know, the stuff that you're talking about is just so magnificent. You can make anything, you know, with a cheap embedded processor and some junk from, you know, torn from a car. I mean, that's one of the things the show showed. So it's really up to all of us, you guys too, to kind of share that with people. So I feel like I've been incredibly blessed that I've been given this really cool podium for doing it. And you guys are now, you know, you go out and do that too, please, I guess. Is that okay for me to ask people to do that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we go to, like, Ohio Linux Fest every year. It's this conference when, you know, Linux users come together and talk about different topics and learn stuff. You know, now you're seeing, like, these regional, you know, going back a few years, the big Linux conference was Linux World Expo, which was became very corporate. But now you're seeing a lot of these regional, smaller conferences like Ohio Linux Fest and Southeast Linux Fest and Scale and Linux Northwest. And it's, you know, it's people that are into the Linux, you know, computers, technology, getting together and sharing the information. And that's really what it is. It's all about, you know, the whole, you know, free and open source software mentality is you learn something, you share the information with other people who might not be as far along as you, and helping them along so that they might help somebody else coming along too.
Now, don't you think that that whole social part of computing that Linux has driven so much has made compute, I mean, it's made it, it's almost like it's chic to be a geek, you know, like it's cool to be a geek again. Do you see it? I see it. I've been around long enough. It was, for a while, it was really pretty, you know, people would turn away when you said you were an engineer or a computer programmer. But now there's this kind of weird geek sensibility, you know, and the whole social networking thing that kind of grew up around that. If you think about it, the whole open source thing, a lot of what everybody uses, you know, things like Facebook and, you know, IRC and stuff like that came out of this community, right? You know, and now everybody does it. I think it's really cool. I think you guys have given us a lot more cred. I remember looking at, you know, I work for one of the biggest corporations in the world, right? And I remember looking at the open source thing going, what are they doing? And now I contribute to open source, you know, mostly in the micro world. I do stuff for Instructables, and I put code out for Arduino and things like that, and I totally get it, but I didn't before. And now I think everybody gets it, this whole contributory, you know, wisdom from anywhere. I just think it's phenomenal. I think it's not only transformed computing, I think it's transforming the world. I really do. I know that sounds you know, kind of hokey, but I really believe it.
It is hokey, but it's so true. You know, it's about building of what's pre-existed, everybody sharing it, making it better, you know, making it more commonplace. You know, the whole, you know, we've had many conversations about Linux adoption, and it seems to be going faster in developing parts of the world, just as a simple fact that, you know, the barriers of what people have existing aren't there.
Yeah, exactly. I just think, I mean, it really challenges the whole notion that you have to hold everything you do close to your chest, and that, you know, the thought that everybody benefits by sharing information is kind of a new thought. That's not the capitalistic, you know, I got to get my investment out way. And, you know, I know I may be on thin ice here because, you know, my company is a big corporate entity, but we're very heavily vested in Linux. I don't want to ask you how you guys view it, but I tell you that my company really believes, you know, we make a good living out of helping the Linux community, and hopefully we're really helping. And we put a lot of energy into it, and our people, at least from my understanding, you know, they compete not compete is the wrong word, is they participate as peers. You know, their allegiance is to the Linux community as much as it is to, you know, to our company, and we work really hard to make sure that, you know, our interests are aligned, and we follow, you know, it's such an interesting thing when I think about the way my company or any other software company evolved. You know, the thought that you would put tens of thousands of people working on something that everyone would benefit from without being able to monetize it directly, that's just like, you know, communist. But at the same time, it works great, and it's transformed our company. You know, it really has. And you have no idea how many Linux buffs we have inside. It's been really cool, and I've been around IBM long enough to see that's just an amazing transformation. And I don't know. I just think it's cool.
That's awesome, you know. I mean, big, huge company like IBM transforming itself and reinventing itself. I mean, they really had to, you know. At one point, they
yeah, I mean, the whole idea of a closed system and stuff like that, which was so much what we were about, the world doesn't benefit from that. And I think, you know, I give a lot of credit to, if I may point to the people, you know, I know a lot of those individuals very close and very well now, and just thinking the foresight just to realize that, you know, everybody, you know, you can get in an environment where you put everyone benefits by everyone's work, and that's just such a cool thought. I mean, that's, you think about if the world could, well, just like I said before, again, I know this is hokey, you know, I think that the world has learned a lot of lessons about collaboration from the open source community and Linux in particular. I think corporations are learning a lot. And you know, when I kind of go back to this whole this smarter planet thing, I'm very, very senior in my company, so I have the good fortune to be able to talk to the people, you know, at every level, up to the chairman's level and I realize that when they invest in something like Linux, or they invest in something like the smarter planet thing, the use of IT for the benefit of the world and green and stuff like that, that they're being honest, that they want to do good, but they also want to make a living, and they figured out a way of aligning both of those things. And that just seems so, it was so foreign before, that to me, you know, being the sort of, you know, neurotic Jewish hippie from Vermont, I came from a background that, you know, big business was somehow opposite of, you know, human interests, and that somehow that, you know, maybe a Marxist thing deep in my soul saying that those couldn't align. And I think what's really brilliant is that my company and many other companies are realizing that you can do good in the world and do good in business. You know, that those things, if you work, you can align those things. You know, it's really funny, you know, one of my heroes is, I work a lot with Ben and Jerry. Ben, you know, from the ice cream companies, they're part of our Burning Man group. And I learned from Ben and his friends this whole notion of aligning your corporate interests with your world interests, and they did it early. And now to watch, you know, my company and other big companies kind of getting in there, and it's not that they're not, you know, they're completely altruistic, it's all about business, but the fact that the business interests align with human interests is just wicked cool. And I think a lot of that comes from the demonstration of being able to do good in an open way. And I personally believe that the Linux, the experience with Linux was a transformational thing in our corporate culture to that, to realize that you can let go, you can pry your hands off of some of these things, you can share your best assets and make a damn good living in doing it. And I think that's really cool.
Very cool. John, we're getting close to the end of the show. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. You've been a great guest.
No one.
Fantastic.
I love the geeks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
We gotta get you to Ohio Linux Fest or Southeast Linux Fest and do a talk. I think everybody would love it.
I would love to do it. I could learn a lot. I'm an Ubuntu fan, and you know, I know that maybe it's a little wimpy, but I could sure use to sharpen my skills. You guys, are these things any particular brand of Linux? I mean, any particular thread, or you guys have everything?
We're all Slackware all the time. That's it, Slackware.
No.
If you're not using Slackware, we don't want to talk to you.
Oh, what's that?
Okay. I hear derision. Yeah, I guess I'm my house is half Debian, half Ubuntu. So.
Okay,
yeah,
well, Debian
I'm
is fine,
I'm into the Ubuntu
too.
Debian. I also like Arch Linux, too. Those three are my main ones.
Well, good. I'm among friends. Well, you guys are totally cool.
We are distro agnostic. We celebrate every distribution. In fact, I don't think there's a distribution
we
don't
hate
like.
SUSE. That's what it is. Right?
No, I think there's a collective non-use of SUSE.
Everybody hates SUSE.
330 probably uses SUSE, doesn't he?
And we even talk about the BSD.
I did it once.
See, he learned his lesson. He's learning, you know.
No, I
had a free
trial.
Had
one time to install it, and you know, Gentoo, the GCC screensaver. You learn after doing that once too.
That's all you need to do it is once.
John, are you running Karmic Koala yet?
No, I'm Ibix right now. So I'm back.
You're too behind.
I've got it.
Falling behind.
I'm in Intrepid. Yeah, I should probably move it up, but I run it on. You know what I do? You guys must do the same thing. Is what I find is old computers, like old laptops that we're throwing away at work because they're too slow. I just put Linux on them, and all of a sudden they're faster than my Windows boxes.
See, all of my computers are hand-me-downs.
Yeah, but you can get so much more life out of them when you run a real operating
system. Oh, yeah.
And usually my work, actually we're transitioning to Linux at work, but I still, you know, my day-to-day job is more Windows-based, and so most of my Linux stuff is for, I have a lab at home, and I have some robotics that work off of that, and my microcontroller stuff, and all my music and everything else. So it's my hacker's machine. And I like that because it's something that I can actually fix if it breaks, or I can go in there and figure it out. Whereas I don't find myself, I guess I'm reasonably good at Windows, but if it doesn't want to work, there's not much you can do sometimes. Whereas Linux, it's transparent. You can actually see, and you can write. And if it doesn't work, you can rewrite it. I like that. Without a license, I like that. So that's what I do all my hacking on.
Sweet. Got to give that Arch Linux a try.
I'll try. I'm not proud. Hey, I started on punch cards, man. That's been the real challenge. I don't know if any of you guys are old-timers, but it's been really interesting to watch this and have to keep relearning this stuff. The nice thing about Linux, also for me, though, is I learned BSD back in... God, what did I learn first Linux? And Unix. I mean, it's still, the base command set is still one of the first operating systems I ever learned. And that's very nice, again, that you can sort of, as I think I was saying at the pre-show, as I was working on my son's Mac, and I'm not a Mac person. I was just like going, what? And I finally said, get me to a command when, underneath there it was Unix, and I could find my way around and build stuff. And it's kind of cool that you can do that, across generations, across platforms, across compute sizes. I just think that's really cool. Well, you guys, I'd love to hear this thing recorded, and
send you a link once it's done.
Intelligent. can you edit it to make it coherent? So I don't sound like I'm really sleep deprived as I am.
No, that removes all the charm of the show. Then our listeners wouldn't know that they were listening to the same program.
we'll shoot you a link with the to the audio files once they're encoded.
That's totally awesome.
Well, I'll tell you what, John, I personally want to thank you for coming on the show, because I think that you are probably easily one of the most interesting guests that we have had on the show in a long time.
Yep.
Yeah, I haven't slept in a week waiting for it.
Fascinated by your stories.
We've talked to a lot of people in the free and open source community, and your interview is probably one of the most interesting ones. I totally agree.
Actually, little you know that 330 didn't actually go to bed since the first time you were supposed to be on, so he's been sleep deprived for like a month.
Uh-oh. I'm so sorry. I actually watched.
I figured that eventually we'll all be numbers, so I figured I should at least get the domain name.
I like it. Hey, do you guys want some names of some other interesting, you know, quirky IBMers? I can give you that.
Sure.
Sure.
We'd love to, if they'd be willing to come on.
Paul McKinney. My friend Paul McKinney. Do you know him? He would be good.
Who, Paul? What's his name, Paul who?
Paul McKinney. But let me go ask him. He would be a good, interesting unit to talk to.
Yeah, you might not want to drop any docs on the show.
Yeah, let's communicate. I'll shoot you an email.
Yeah, that sounds great. Well, we'll find you some good Linux interesting units.
We've spoken to some IBM people in the past.
Yeah, and I would love to hear, you know, exactly what IBM is doing to it during their transition over to Linux, too. I mean, I understand they're doing stuff with, communication suite that they're working on? Lotus and stuff like that is becoming, like, workable under Linux. And
it's been there for, like, a year and a half, 2 years already.
Yeah, but they keep improving it, you know what I mean? Initially, it really was stinky.
Yeah, all of our corporate wear works under Linux. And a lot of our chip design stuff is under Linux. So, you know, we're transitioning. But it'll be interesting the next couple of years. Resistance is futile.
So is that it tonight, gentlemen?
I think so. We're going to wrap it up.
Is it time to play out the audio that you will not hear?
That we won't hear, yeah.
You won't hear, but the audience will.
Your audio through your mixer properly, Dan.
Someday we'll hear it again.
It'll be back.
I'll talk about you guys in my blog.
Thank
John,
you.
John, do you have
John.
Do you do a Denica or Twitter?
Yeah, I'm John Cone VT at Twitter.
Cool. We'll subscribe.
We'll have to get all your information. We'll send you an email so we can get it in our show notes and stuff like that.
Yeah, that'd be
sure,
great. Yeah,
a lot
I was
of people
just checking
who are listening
website.
Tonight are going to love to, you know, listen to your stuff.
Oh, it was really fun talking to you guys.
Great
Thank
talking
you very
to you.
Much.
Well, very good guest, John. We appreciate it.
All right, no problem. Again, I apologize for being AWOL the other day.
Yeah, don't worry about it. We'll
go out
sounds
there
like
and
I
share
said
your
that you were on.
Remember,
that's right.
Pass on the geekiness. All right, you guys. Good night.
Good night.
Have
a good
night.
Night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Night.
Any words for the good of
oh, well,
the
speaking
crowd?
Of speaking of good night, let me plug.
Good
Freedom
night, everybody.
Again.
Thanks, Link. Have a good night. What?
Shut up. Let me plug Free Linux Box again. Listen, guys, I was on Computer America last night plugging Free Linux Box. I'm going to do it again here really fast.
Cool.
Especially since John was talking about, you know, all the old computers that they're pitching at IBM that can run Linux on it. I'm assuming that you all listening have old computers that can run Linux too, and maybe your business. If so, please go to freelinuxbox.org and, you know, hook us up with some old computers and make somebody else happy. Help increase the community size by donating your old Linux computer to someone who could really use it.
I was going to say, after being on the show, did you get a free copy of Windows Cleaner or anything that they're always giving away?
Yeah, you know what? What I found really funny, and I posted this in the IRC, was the first commercial that was on, or the second commercial I was on, after I started talking, was Windows removal or something like that. Which, you know, they were talking about like your house windows and stuff, but it really was funny, kind of, to me. They had this long spiel about how this company was great at Windows removal. So I
on a computer? Wait, was that actual house windows?
Yeah, it was house windows.
On a computer show?
It took the longest time before they actually made it clear that they were talking about house windows. You know, they rambled on about it for, you know, 10 or 20 seconds before you finally figured out that's really what they're talking about.
Canonical
then,
should
like,
copy
later
the,
on, after I was,
the ad.
Yeah, later on after I was off the air and the other guys were talking, I kept listening for just a couple minutes, and they went right into they have some kind of prize thing, a giveaway or whatever, and all the prizes that they were giving away were like Windows Registry Cleaner and, you know, some kind of some kind of McAfee or something like that. You know what I mean? All bunch of Windows software and crap they were giving away. So I thought that was sort of funny as well that they were doing that right in the middle of their once monthly all Linux all the time show.
At least they do that.
But
know?
Hey, you know, exposure is exposure, so.
Exactly.
That was good.
Yeah, hats off to Larry Busey for his work there. And, of course, hats off to you, Mr. Link. I'm still waiting for a commercial for freelinuxbox.org. But also, I would love to have a
I'll send you one, but, like, I'm on the show all the time, and I can't.
I know. Well, for those days you're not on the show, and we completely forget that that even exists.
Okay, I'll send one over.
And another one. It would be nice to have a little blurb for Mythcast. Myth TV.
Yeah,
Cast.
People have been asking me to do that. I should do that.
And
little promo.
Any other podcasts out there, you know, like Linux Cranks.
Linux Cranks. Definitely.
Or Linux...
excuse me, gentlemen. Linux Cranks is an OG cast.
Yeah.
I had to, I'm
TV
sorry.
Cast.
My mistake.
The TV cast has no MP3 file.
So, for the OG casts out there in the in the biosphere... Yes. That's it. I'm gonna. Oh crap! I'm gonna play this.
Oh, Merry Christmas, everybody.
Why you're not gonna
be
on next week?
Merry Christmas.
I'm game for being on next week.
My little sister's coming from California, so I'm not gonna be able to be on next week.
I'm off next week, so I'm down for a all night show.
I'm off too, but it's my
well, you know what? Who cares if your sister's coming next week? What's more important, the show or your sister?
My sister.
Bring her on the show. We'll play some Dova.
I haven't seen her in like 2 years. So.
Merry Christmas, Dova.
Merry Christmas. Merry Dova.
You really
want to
know?
We
should do
a
Christmas show with just Dova playing in the background.
Dova's coming out with a Christmas album.
You know, if you put a little sleigh bells behind some of their stuff, you could do it, you know.
Just jingling in the background.
Really.
No one would ever know.
Instead of cowbell, you have bells ringing.
Maybe I'll dust off some Dova for next week's show.
You might have
I hope
to.
You do, Dan. Those are my favorite episodes.
All right, well, happy Merry Christmas, Link. But I'm sure I'll talk to you between now and then. Thank you for all your help with the server and stuff. And
how's that going, by the way? Everything's all set now?
We're using it. Once I stop taking the lazy way out and doing it the right way, everything worked.
Always take the time to do it the right way, Dan.
Yeah.
Don't cut corners.
Live and learn. Easy, bum.
Now,
all right,
if you'd have done it the right way the first time, it would have taken you a shorter amount of time, right?
Yeah, it wouldn't have taken me 2.5 days. All right, tonight's music is Princess Mononoke from Louis Ling and the Bombs off the Long Live the Anarchist Revolutionaries album. You guys won't hear it, so the people on the stream and on the podcast will enjoy. And on the Oddcast.
Unlike you guys, I actually listen to the shows.
Yeah, you scumbags. All right. With
that... Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Nighty night.
Oh, hey, Alan's on? Hi, Alan.
Hey, what's up?
If you're done
talking... I know,
talking
I'm very quiet. What can I do?
All right, I'm playing it out.
Yeah.
Ah! またね。
Can we talk about the new search of computers?
Can we talk about multiprocessing?
Can we talk about Beowulf clusters?
Can we talk about Web 2.0?
Just talk geek to me.
Hey, it's Deep Geek. Please come check out my podcast for my take on all things geeky. You can find us at www.talkgeektome.us. That's www.talkgeektome.us. Thank you.
Just talk geek to me.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
And that is it. That is it.
Alrighty then.
Verily.
Hey, 330, you still on?
No, he's gone.
He jumped off. I was going to let him know that Randall Schwartz is asking for people to help him pay his bills by sending him $1 to PayPal account.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, pay the bills for Foss or just his bills in general?
No, he's like his bills at home. He goes, okay, I'm stupid. I'll have to pick what bills to pay in December if I can't get some cash. PayPal, and then he gives his email address. $1 will help.
Really?
I should do that, man. Shit.
Where's that at?
Twitter.
I thought he was, like, rich.
I guess Leo is holding out on them.
Damn. You know what it...
You dropped out, Dan. I didn't hear what you said. I said.
I said what it was the Aug feed that bankrupted them.
Yeah, all the extra work.
That's terrible.
All that extra work to do the Aug feed. It took away from his paying jobs so that he could pay his bills.
Well, I hope that things work out for him because it sucks not having money.
Yeah, you need money to survive.
Well, speaking of that, I'm going to put this show to bed so I can go to bed and get to work tomorrow and make some money.
Definitely. So next week we'll go, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm in, so. We'll definitely do a show next week. Even if it's just us.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay, cool. But
what is next week?
Next week?
It's the 23rd, not the 24th or the 25th.
Yeah, it's 2 days before Christmas, man.
Yeah.
Big deal.
Made it sound like it's a special day. Yeah.
It's not Christmas night.
No. Yeah. Well, I'll be there next week, so no worries about
that. Yeah, me too. Yep.
All right, man. Have a good night.
Have a good one. Take care.
But I can't, I think. But I have
That's
to
okay.
confess.
Go up,
I'm running.
Go
I'm
up
running.
Front, a little bit.
Yeah, as we... Huh?
That's why I'm here. My name is Link.
I love it.
We can link back to anything.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, Joel. Hey,
where?
That's not Joel.
That's not Joel. Who's that? 330?
Do I sound that bad?
What have you done with
no,
Joel?
No, you sound really good.
You killed Joel.
No, I just That's took over true. Something kind of techie studios.
Oh, 330. You sound fantastic, actually, for once.
Thank you.
No,
where are most of you?
We're spread out. Me and Alan are still Link is down there, Philly.
Yeah, I'm
Pat
in Philly.
And Alan are still in Lehigh Valley. We're in Easton, PA. Dan is down in Virginia.
Hampton Roads, baby. Represent.
330 is in Indiana. When Joel jumps in, he's going to be in Columbus, Ohio. And then if Dave Yates joins us, he's in South Carolina. And if Chad jumps in, he's in Virginia.
South Hill, Virginia.
So we're all spread out now.
Yeah, on the internet. Back most time.
And John, you're up in where, in Vermont?
I am.
What part of Vermont?
Let's see, Eastern, Northwest, Central. I'm Central Vermont, North Central Vermont. If you can think of
Burlington,
Ben and Jerry's. I'm halfway between Burlington and Stowe, or Burlington and Ben and Jerry's.
Okay, I know that area real. That's a nice area up there.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It really is beautiful.
I love Vermont. Vermont's they actually have weather. You guys probably have snow up there, right?
Oh, it's. I just picked my youngest up at the ski mountain that's 7 miles from us, and it was 9 degrees and blowing like a son of a bitch. So it was.
Wow.
So I don't know what it's like where you are, but that's 9 degrees thermometer temperature.
But they have two kinds of weather. It's raining and shitty hot,
mm-hmm.
and that's it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I'm originally
here. It's a robust climate. I just saw in some travel brochure they say we have a robust climate. I like it.
That's great for skiing in the wintertime if that's a thing.
Yeah, and that's only 9 months of the year, so that's good. Now, actually, it's gotten a little bit, you know, I'm not a climatographer or climatologist or whatever, but it's not as cold as early as it was. We had our latest real snowfall. I mean, normally we would have, you know, pretty reliable snow cover from early, you know, earlier mid-November, and it was early December before we had snow cover. So we'll have snow between now and May, pretty much. Which I like.
It's 8:30, Dan. We're going to start the show?
I'm just making sure that the stream is going okay. I'm concerned that it's not.
Still having problems, man? Hardware related?
Couldn't be the operating system.
No.
No, Dan has hardware issues.
Just the operator over there.
Yeah, that too.
Pebcac.
That's it for sure.
I just want to check something quickly.
Where do you guys stream from?
Servers in Virginia with Dan.
All right. We're going to start in just a minute. I need to bring down the streamer.
Will we hear sound this time?
No.
Okay. We didn't fix that from last week, huh?
No. I had other things I had to fix.
Do I need
no
to like make
sound?
A theme
is that what
song?
The deal is?
No, you won't be able to hear it, but it'll be there. I'm trying to figure. You know, I have an idea as to what happened, and I will be fixing it shortly.
Finally, gonna uninstall Windows.
Yeah, Windows 7.
That he has running on his MacBook.
So
yeah,
I had a weird, kind of a otherworldly experience. I was down working with my son the other day on something, and he's a Mac guy, and I was frustrated. I didn't know where I was, and I dropped down into the, and I didn't realize that it was actually like BSD or something underneath it, and I knew where I was. It was, I mean, I'd heard that, but I finally got a command window and could actually run the thing. It was kind of surprising. I didn't realize how Unixy it was.
Yeah, it catches
you
at first until you actually expect it to work the same way perfectly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then you realize how limiting it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, it's refreshing.
Better than Windows, I guess.
Hmm. I have to tell you, I'm typing on an XP box right now. I'm not proud.
That's it. This is over. Before it even began.
Not by choice. No machine I own.
House. Ah, there we go. Now we're streaming.
Stream is up.
See, look at that.
That's a theme.
What? Where'd everybody go?
I'm here.
We're here.
I'm still
right,
here.
I thought Link was about to offer an opinion that wasn't warranted. Beauty of virtual machines.
Shut up.
Wow. Did he just sound like a Cylon to anyone else?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, he did.
Comcast is traffic shaping again.
Yep, love the Comcast. By your command.
Oh my god.
You want to fix that before we start?
By your command.
I can plug into a... You said I'll plug into a... A hard one. Fine. Still doing it?
We Hello? Have stream... What?
Hello?
Hello? Yeah, you sound great now. You ready?
I'm going to plug this thing into, a real internet connection. Maybe I can keep that from happening.
Now he sounds like he's sped up. That's funny.
Let's see what we got here. How's that?
I'm ready to go. That's fine.
You sound okay. Fine, man.
Yeah, you sounded
good.
Fine.
I'm good. Do it.
All right. You probably aren't going to hear anything until I get the pulse audio crap fixed on this system, so I will let you know when the show intro is over. John, once I tell you that the intro is over, we'll get right into the interview with you, good sir. So it'll be approximately 45 seconds. For the intro, okay?
I'm so nervous.
Is my makeup okay?
You might want to powder your face just a little bit more. And maybe a little blood.